Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Roof Podcast. As always, I'm Carter Spires. You're here with my co-host, Matthew Bartlett, the owner and managing editor of The Roost, your premier source for Rice sports news and analysis. Well, that was a pretty nice way to end the season.
I'm thinking we should have just started the podcast in November.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What it took, right?
If we just cut it to like the last five games or so, they had a winning record. So, you know.
I'll take that. Sample size.
Yeah. Give me that bowl invite.
Works for me.
Yeah. We'll review that game coming up, obviously. And then after some housekeeping items, usual stuff to out of the way beforehand. And then we will wrap up the show by talking about a little update on the redshirt situation with some of the mostly freshmen, a couple other guys on this team that did and didn't use their redshirt year this season. And then we'll save the kind of more full big picture season review stuff for our last regular season episode next week.
Yeah, we thought about going for 3 hours, but decided that we might be better to split things up a little bit. So
yeah, you all just wanted 180 straight unadulterated minutes of this, right?
I mean, if that's really what you want, then so leave us a comment, go write us a review, send us a tweet, message, post on the forum. I mean, I guess we could make it happen. But if the majority of you don't want to listen to us ramble for that long, yeah, we'll split a happy medium. So that one piece, another housekeeping piece, as Carter mentioned, first off, we did this last year, and I think it was really valuable for me when I was putting things together. We do a postseason survey that's up on the site right now. You just go to attheroost.com. There's a big banner that says, please take this postseason survey. And last year, one of the big outflowings from that survey was that y'all wanted a podcast. And lo and behold, here's Carter. And here's the Roost podcast. So I'm not promising to implement all of the suggestions that get put there, but I really do value your opinions and want to make the site and the show as informative and helpful as possible. So please, I think it's like 6 or 7 questions. If you could take some time and go ahead to the website and fill that out, I would appreciate it very, very much. And, you know, leave us general site comments. If you like the podcast, if you don't like the podcast, anything under the sun. Happy to hear it. So that's one piece. And then other thing that's going on the site right now, and kind of a sneak peek at our next podcast. So every year I close the season. I say every year, this is year two. So I guess it's happened twice. So now it's
every year thus far.
Every year thus far. I can say it and sound like, you know, we'll get to 10 years eventually, but you got to go through 1 and 2 first. Anyhow, ending the year with what I like to call just our postseason superlatives. So we'll go through, you know, team MVP, offensive player of the year. The first one that went up this week that is already up by the time we're recording this was special teams player of the year, and that was Garrett Grammer. And really, really cool. Usually, I think when we think of specialists, we think punters, kickers, things like that. This is just a regular special teamer who covers kicks and blocks for field goals and does everything out of the sun. So really cool to get to tell his story. And I'll be doing more of the ones that are of the MVP kind of caliber, categories over the next couple weeks. But what we're going to do is a part of our next episode that we could use your help on, if you're listening, is want to come up with some more out of the box, more creative superlatives that we can give out. We're throwing out ideas of like maybe it was your favorite play of the year, which doesn't have to be good or bad, just your favorite or the player that you were most surprised by in a good way or bad way, things like that, things that are a bit off the wall.
It could be the goofiest play of the year. This is college football after all, so
the goofiest, the riciest play of the year, any of those. So we're already writing stuff down, but if you have any suggestions, maybe this could be a staple category forever, for every year, from starting with now. So, all good things. And, you know, Carter and I are having a fun time doing this, so we'd like to put some fun and put that together. That'll be out on our next show. So if you have any ideas, please do write in and let us know. If you want to, email us podcast@theroosh.com, Twitter, Facebook, the forum, anywhere. We'll see it. And looking forward to that. So I guess, do we want to hit on last bit of Rice piece first or some Conference USA?
We don't have a lot for other Rice sports this week. The I know the women's basketball team had they played Northern Arizona and trailed a little bit. Don't seem to have entirely pulled out of their early season funk, maybe, but pulled out of it by the end and cruised to a fairly comfortable victory. And then I
like having funks and winning.
Yeah, for sure. But that was the only, like, they and the men have been off because I presume it's finals time right about now. So they and the men have kind of been off after the flurry of regular season activity, or the flurry of early season activity in November. So the only other bit of Rice news we have is on the volleyball team, right?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think there's one basketball game coming up this weekend, but the rest, I think we got the Puerto Rico tournament coming up for the women, but that's in right before Christmas. So yeah, basketball has a good break.
Yeah, I was looking at the schedule today. The men's basketball team has a nice stretch of Texas schools in the Southland Conference, but they're also playing the University of St. Thomas, which those of you Houstonians will recognize. It's a little school over in Montrose. They just moved up to Division III, which I didn't even realize you were allowed to play Division III schools in your regular season schedule, but I guess you are. So.
I mean, they have the football for college football. I think there's some sort of penalty when it comes to bowl selections that you can only count one FCS win towards your six qualifying wins.
Yep.
Is there a similar tournament caliber rule for basketball?
Yeah, at this point, I guess they can.
If you wanted, well, I think Texas A&M in the non-conference schedule played the women's national team. I saw a couple weeks ago, which I thought was peculiar because, you know, that beat the hell out of everything is the Aggies, you know, favorite cheer. But I didn't check. I don't know if they did beat the hell out of Team USA or not during that game. I'm guessing probably not.
Probably not. It's like, I don't think if Alabama ever played like Army in football that they would do Ram or Jammer, because I don't think that "we just beat the hell out of you, Army" is like a an endorsed sentiment for most people in Alabama.
Yeah, probably not. So yeah, so that ceases to say that there's not a ton of things going on in Rice sports. So volleyball on tap this in this week, playing OU in College Station, get a chance at the Aggies, got an at-large bid to the NCAA tournament. So that's exciting. They're having had a tremendous regular season, and we wish them the best of success. And so that's it for Rice pieces. And the final Conference USA notes are, we already have we'll start with the last game. FAU and UAB will play in the championship game this upcoming weekend. I hadn't looked at the projections or anything, but I think FAU is going to be somewhere around like a touchdown and a half favorite or so over UAB. No extensive tiebreakers involved in setting that matchup.
Yeah, I bet the conference office is happy about that.
Mm-hmm. So should be a game. And then I noticed that we don't even have all of the conference championship games set. Well, they're set yet. They haven't been played, but they've already started giving out bowl invitations. So I saw Charlotte under Will Healy, good story in year one. They're going to the Bahamas. And also Tyson Helton, Western Kentucky, they're clinched bowl eligibility. They haven't announced, I don't think they're, we'll have a lot more destinations come out over the next coming weekend, but keep your eyes peeled for those. And, you know, Rice will not be playing in one of those this year, but if you take a last three game sample size, then they've won all of the games that they've played. So maybe we can continue that on into next year.
I mean, we'll talk about this a lot more next week, but I mean, I know football is not this simple, but they won three games and were real close in a whole lot of others this year, and they get basically the whole team back next year. So
I like that. Let's talk more about that.
I will not be at all surprised if we're discussing potential bowl potential bowl destinations at this time next year.
Yeah, absolutely expectation. And I think part of the reasons we'll transition now and talk about UTEP, the reason we kind of are starting to feel more confident about that being the trajectory of the program and where we're going next year is after watching them do what they were supposed to do and beat UTEP.
Yeah, it was refreshing. It felt a little sketchy maybe at some points in like the second quarter when Kyle Loxley and the UTEP offense kind of got going and got them a little bit of a lead. And then Loxley went down and UTEP didn't score anymore after that. But, you know, what I'll say about that is, you know, you play the hand you're dealt, and what you're supposed to do when the other team's quarterback goes down and they have to put in the backup on a moment's notice is to bow up on defense and shut them out. And Rice did that. You know, we talked about going into this game that they had had one game. You know, it was nice to get those two wins that they did coming into this, but Rice had one game all year before this when they were favored to win and they couldn't pull that one out. So, you know, even if you can say they maybe got a little lucky facing a backup quarterback, well, they also turned the ball over twice, once in the end zone for an immediate score. So breaks went both ways. And ultimately they were able to just do what they were supposed to do, which is really nice to see.
Yeah. And let's not forget, like, yes, UTEP played a backup quarterback, but to be fair, Rice has played 7 quarterbacks in 2 years under Mike Lindgren. The luxury of every team having a healthy starting quarterback that's very, very good for 12 games of a college football season, like, that's rare and doesn't happen. And a quarterback going down in the middle of a game is probably not as unheard of as we'd like to think about it. So it was funny. I was comparing notes with some folks that cover the team, and I noticed doing my research that Gavin Hardison, the backup for UTEP, had come in and played a couple games prior. And I was just asking him, like, so is this a situation where Loxley's on, you know, a bit of thin ice, or that just want to get the new guy reps and take a look at next year? And the exact words were, some disaster would have to take place for this backup to come in, even though they were optimistic about what they saw and thought he would be a good guy for the future. They didn't think he was quite ready now. And I think we kind of saw that once Hardison came in the game. The offense just absolutely disappeared. And I mean, granted, they got one offensive touchdown before he came into the game. So it's not like UTEP was going crazy.
Yeah, like, let's not oversell the success there. Like, they, you know, they had 16 points when Loxley went out, but 6 of those were on a touchdown on a fumble that they got in the end zone. So, and you know, we talked about last week, like, with Loxley at the helm, this was like a pretty good offense. So,
you scored know, 5 touchdowns the week prior.
Yeah. So I don't think there's much to be ashamed of in terms of what they gave up, you know, over the course of, you know, a couple drives between the middle of the first quarter and late in the second there. So,
no, I thought Loxley looked really good. And we kind of talked about this coming into the game, comparing to Middle Tennessee and Ashro Hara and what that attack looked like. That, you know, this is kind of another one of those dual threat kind of guys. And I think not exactly sure watching it what Loxley was really doing that different, but his commitment to run first and his vision in the field, I thought, you know, opened some things up where he was not getting stopped for a yard very often. He was finding 3 or 4 or 5 yard gains and being able to move the chains. And they moved the ball pretty well in the first half. And that was part of what kept, I mean, Rice didn't have any points in the second quarter. And part of that was because UTEP was doing a good job possessing the football. And I thought that's something that Loxley was doing really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I was just taking and UTEP actually won the overall time of possession battle in this game, built largely on the strength of those second quarter drives where they really kept the ball a lot longer than Rice did. But I mean, you know, they made the plays when they had to. When they had the opportunity to face a backup quarterback, they, you know, they shut him out in the second half. They may have had the very first drive was an absolutely excellent defensive and special teams drive. You know, they got a sack to force fourth down, and then what did they tip the punt?
It's something like that. I couldn't really get a good. I couldn't really see much of an impact, but it was not. It was not a good punt.
Yeah,
but I think the verdict was it was tipped to some degree.
And then you know the offense came in and immediately converted that to points. So
yeah, and I mean the offense. I think this is notable. So Tom Stewart started the game, went 8 for 16, 115 yards, one touchdown, and one interception that was not good. Underthrew. I mean, Rosner is so big that as long as you put him out in front of him, like he's going to get a hand on it. And underthrew Rosner pretty bad, and ended up getting picked off on coverage where UTEP was not playing one corner. He had a safety deep, and it just was not either didn't read it right or didn't make a good throw. And then from that point onward, you know, Tom Stewart, even though he got some. Was a part of the early touchdown drives in the first quarter. It was all Giovanni Johnson from, I guess, what was that, midway through or second drive of the third quarter on, something like that?
Yeah, thereabouts.
Which was exciting.
Yeah, and what's funny about it, and it's interesting in some way. I'm actually just looking at this now. It's interesting in some ways because Giovanni threw one pass and it was incomplete. But, you know, he came in and, you know, he had 10 rushes for 62 yards and two touchdowns. You know, you would like to see a little bit more out of the passing game there. But on the flip side, they actually ran the ball really, really well for kind of one of the only times all season. Obviously, the overall average of 7.3 yards a carry is buoyed up a little bit by the multiple long runs that Aston Walter had. But, you know, no team gets to above like 5.5 yards a carry or so without some big runs that bring that up. You know, nobody runs for exactly 8 yards a carry every single time. So, you know, when you're consistently making 10, 11, 12, 20, 30 plus yard runs, that's pretty solid. And, you know, I thought the offensive line played great on the whole. You know, I was looking at plays today for the film room, which is going to be up a little later this week, but there were several plays, you know, kind of watching the highlights and stuff where the offensive line just, you know, they're just running basic stuff and they just did a great job of getting a hat on a hat. I mean, that the 64 yarder that Aston Walter had, that was on a play. They were at Rice's 20 yard line and there was not a single receiver on the field. They were in 23 personnel. So they had Walter and a fullback and three tight ends that were all crammed in close to the line of scrimmage, and then you could draw a little box around the defense, and all 11 players were inside the tight ends within like 6 yards of the line of scrimmage, and they blocked everybody up. And if Aston had, you know, just a little bit more speed in fifth gear, it would have been a 80-yard touchdown. So. And then both of Giovanni's touchdowns were on the same kind of QB power play. And in both of them, it was just, they just blocked it up perfectly. And he kind of waltzed into the end zone. So I thought the offensive line overall, at least in run blocking, had one of their best days of the year.
Yeah. And again, that was with Isaac Klarkowski, the true freshman walk-on center who was playing in his second game. After appearing in no games all season, was the center for two of Rice's three wins, which is pretty impressive. And then I don't know if you hadn't, I did a piece that I put up last week prior to the UTEP game that about Rice's walk-on program and kind of their vision of that's one of their key wins, and wrote about that it was actually Friday night before the game that Klarkowski was definitively told, like, okay, yes, you're officially the guy. We're not thinking about this anymore. It's you. And so him and Brian Chafin, who of course spent 4 years in this scheme at Stanford, got into a hotel room, pushed the beds against the wall, and for 45 minutes put hands on shoulders and practiced and blocked and did every single play in the playbook. And then went out and played, which was phenomenal. So he did a great job, had some good blocks, and then Aston, I think, and you mentioned the, so he averaged 9.3 yards per carry, and like if you take out that one big run, but I think what was notable about Aston's runs were, okay, one run in 16 carries, he failed to gain a yard. Every other carry he had, all 15 other carries, were for positive yardage. And he had a run of 30 yards, which was a touchdown. He had a run of 20 yards, and he had a run of 64 yards. So if it's, you know, 164-yard run and a lot of 3-, 4-, 2-yard carries, then yeah, that skews it. But if you're chunking off multiple yard markers on one on runs, then clearly something was working, and he was pretty electric with the ball. And then on the other running piece, I thought this was interesting. So if we're going way back, and I don't know if we want to draw too many parallels to the Old Dominion game last year, but actually what happened last year is Wylie Green started the Old Dominion game in the regular season finale. He got hurt, and they ended up moving back to Sean Stankavage, bringing in the backup quarterback, so to speak, for the remainder of the game. Sean Stankavage did not attempt a pass. He did not complete a pass or attempt a pass in the second half. And you kind of saw a similar script against UTEP, and Giovanni only attempted one pass but didn't complete a pass, and it was because Rice didn't need to throw, which is ideally where this offense wants to be. They want to be able to throw, but if they can just hand the ball off to guys like Aston, who are going to get 20 yards, or you know, Zane Knipp, who's averaging, I think I said 12.9 yards every time he touches the football, got his first career catch in this game. If you have guys like that that you can just hand the ball off to, you don't need to throw.
Yeah. And I was laughing earlier. I forgot to include the reason. Giovanni was 0 of 1 for 0 yards, an average of 0 yards an attempt for no touchdowns and no interception. His total QBR per ESPN was 98.1.
Is that out of 100, correct?
On a 100-point scale. So he ran real good.
Yeah, that's not too bad. And that's exactly how they were practicing during the week leading up. Giovanni was taking all of that kind of run option and kind of wildcatty type packages, and he drilled it and drilled it and drilled it until he was comfortable with it and had Tom End running kind of the more conventional offense. And that's kind of exactly what we saw play out in the game. And I don't think it's a coincidence either that when they made the transition, was Stewart had thrown that interception, and it's like, all right, we trust Giovanni. And then he went out and finished the game.
Yeah.
So pretty impressive performance by the offense. And I noticed that went out. Pro Football Focus does a team of the week for every conference, offense and defense, after the game. And they had, I believe it was Clay Servin, Shea Baker, and Aston Walter were named the Pro Football Focus Team of the Week for offense on Conference USA, which essentially is less of a, not just pure stat-based, but more performance-based. And there's a lot of science behind how they put their numbers, good or bad, you can like them or not. But pretty impressive that you go from an offense at the beginning of the year that scored 7 points against Army, that has three guys being recognized on a week that everyone in the conference is playing is some of the best offensive players that week.
Yeah. And the PFF list and the way they do their grading, like, you know, you can quibble with it on the margins. But the way they do that is, I mean, they literally have people go through and watch every single player on every single snap in every single game. And they're assigning a play by play grade. You know, I've seen it explained before where they do like a maximum of like +2 and a minimum of -2 or like a lower bound of -2 per play. So they go through and assign that, and you might quibble a play here or there where you disagree about the grade they assigned, and you know that affect the final number a little bit. But on the whole, in a broad sense, like if someone's going through and they know what they're talking about, which most of those guys do, I follow a lot of them. If they know what they're talking about, you know, you're watching every single play and assigning those grades, there's a fairly good foundation behind that. So I always take it, you know, when players on teams I root for are guys that I like, get high grades from them. I always take that, pretty put a lot of stock in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's not the end all be all, but it is notable, and it's especially notable that two of those guys are coming back. And the running back depth is not something we will, well, I mean, we'll hit on this eventually, but not something I think we're terribly concerned about with the level of playmakers they have there, especially with Juma Ottaviano. And I think we kind of mentioned this in coming up into the week that for redshirt purposes, they were, if they didn't have to use him, and health purposes, I didn't think they were going to, and they ended up not having to. So he didn't even play in this game, and of course, you know, he ran for 200 yards in the, against Old Dominion in the end of last year's game, and so he'll be back and healthy for a full season next year. So that'll be nice. But yeah, I thought Charlie Booker had a couple good. I think he was in a lot on some of the Giovanni Johnson running plays. He had a couple really nice blocks. He didn't do much carrying the football, but kind of was really effective on that.
Yeah, ending. he was the lead blocker on both of the because those QB power plays they ran for Giovanni's touchdown. They set it up to look like it was going to be like sort of a zone read type thing, but it was literally just regular power, except they had the running back playing the role of the fullback, the lead blocker. So it's a nice little kind of wrinkle that can throw defenses off a little bit, and he did a really good job on both of those blocks.
Yeah, you're not expecting the running back to come at you without the football blocking for the guy who does have the football. That's probably not conventional.
Yeah, especially when you're not used to blocking like nine guys in the box on a power run anyway. So
yeah, I mean, and It was really nice, a really nice day for the offense. Like, I think, so what did they top out? I guess 31 points against UTSA, 30 points against UTEP. So second highest offensive output of the season. And it got to the point in the second half where there wasn't a ton of desperation that they could just go out there and kind of, you know, salt the game away and run the ball and control the clock and milk it. And they didn't have to go out and score 40 points. That was kind of my pie in the sky of, and I really wish I could see this team score 40 points. And from what I saw, like, I think they're absolutely capable of it. I think once you were up by as big as you were in the second half, then you kind of just were able to kind of squeeze it on defense and put things away without having to take too many risks.
Yeah.
Which, when your defense is playing like that, a 2-touchdown lead feels like a lot more.
Yeah, and when your offensive line and your backs are playing well and you're playing against a team that absolutely cannot stop the run, like facing a backup court. Like I'm normally a big fan of do not throw your offense into sit on a lead mode until you have like minimum a 3-touchdown lead in the fourth quarter. But you know, you're having that kind of a day on offense and the other team's backup quarterback is in the game and the other team can't stop the run at all. Like, you can throw that one into second gear pretty early.
And, you know, not everyone has the luxury of cheering for teams that frequently have 3-touchdown leads in the fourth quarter, regardless of how good they are. So there's that. And then I did want to highlight, we have slowly seen over the past couple weeks, Zane Knipe get involved. And I mentioned him earlier, had 2 carries this game for 25 yards. And, like, I swear, like, I doesn't, again, hire Carter and I as defensive analysts, it doesn't take much rocket science. When they put him on the field, they used him a good portion of the time. And when he went in motion, the first thing I was looking pre-snap was, where is the football? Because so far, he has carried it for a handful of times this season, 6 or 7 times. He's gotten, I think, the fewest amount of yardage he got on one of those sweeps was 7 yards. And he broke one. The first one he got on against UTEP went for 17. And I was talking with
nearly scored on that one.
Yeah, it looked like he was maybe just one more wriggle free way on the sideline of. And I've watched him in practice so many times that I think I know how fast he is. But every time I see him with the football, I'm just like, man. And so I don't know if I shared this last week when he was getting back or I hadn't yet shared it on the podcast, but I was talking with wide receivers coach Mike Kershaw about Zane. And I said, you know, obviously you would have liked to have this guy in your offense all year. What's he going to let you do against UTEP that, you know, has kind of been missing? And he said, players this fast don't come to Rice, which I thought was pretty frank and honest.
Yeah.
And I was like, "That okay." And then after watching him on the field again, I was like, he's right. He is a difference maker with his speed. And, you know, had some lower body injuries, hamstring this season. So you kind of never really saw him be the full Zane that he could be. And that's kind of why the wide receiver tree for Rice was pretty slim. It was just Austin Trammell and Brad Rosner really this year. I guess with a little bit of August Pete and Jake Bailey sprinkled in. But man, if we can get Zane healthy for the future, like if you're going to give us two free first downs a game.
Yeah, a guy that can run like that. I mean, you know, I was thinking this with Giovanni, and again, we'll dive into this stuff deeper, you know, next week and maybe some in the offseason. But, you know, as diverse of a running game as they have and as good of a runner as Giovanni is, and, you know, the things you can do when you take the plays that Rice can run, all the different blocking schemes they use and stuff like that, you can throw the option elements with Giovanni on there. In this conference especially, you don't need to do a whole lot in the passing game. You don't have to have an NFL passing game with all the different route concepts and combinations on. Like, you don't have to do anything fancy. You just got to be able to make the plays that are there when they load the box up. So, you know, if Giovanni can just progress a little bit as a passer to where he can just, you know, make the open throws that are there, kind of like Tom was doing for, you know, when he had his best successes this season, they're going to be able to do a ton of stuff. And, you know, one thing that they could do as part of that, it's like, man, just get it out to Knipe on a screen. Cause like, you know, you get a guy out there and you've got the numbers, like, guys don't have to hold their blocks for very long. If you get this guy just like a snippet,
not with him.
A snippet of an edge against USA defensive backs, I mean, he could take that to the end zone.
Yeah, and we saw he was sprinkled in a little bit, and we saw him, he broke off. He had his first reception of the year, only reception of the year, went for 42 yards. And we saw Zane and we saw Giovanni in this game. We didn't see Juma. We haven't had a game this year where we've seen Juma and Giovanni and Zane, which arguably might be the three most athletic, quickest, burstiest. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
A quick acceleration on all three of those guys that have that extra gear. We haven't seen that offense on the field. And Rice scored 30 points against UTEP. So I was encouraged by what we did see and the flashes, you know, and now we got to wait. And most importantly, maybe not most importantly, but importantly, picking up from last week, they did score after halftime.
We will not have any
250-day halftime
and 10-month droughts without scoring in the second half.
Yeah, two touchdowns and a field goal.
Yeah, scored more points in the second half than they did in the first half.
Hey, I'll take that.
We're on the up.
Scored as many points in the second half as UTEP had all game.
Win a lot of games doing that.
Yeah, and another second half shutout for the defense, which, I mean, in one of the touchdowns that UTEP did score was, I mean, that I was watching it. Some on the broadcast said something about a bad snap, but kind of just hit Tom in the hand and glanced off and ended up on the ground. I kind of thought that was on Tom for not being aware and catching it, but that was one of the two touchdowns that UTEP was able to score. So, I mean, you're progressing well to the point where now you're holding a CUSA team that I don't know where UTEP finished in the offensive rankings, but probably somewhere around middle-ish of the pack, maybe a little bit lower than that. A pretty good offense. I mean, better than UTSA, I would think.
Yeah.
And UTSA had a good amount of success against the Rice defense, but being able to hold them to one offensive touchdown and a field goal, again, another mark of this defense being able to shut down and impose their will, especially going into the halftime trailing.
Yeah, you give up 10 points on defense in a game, and you'll be in good shape most of the time.
Yeah, at that point, you can win a game with two offensive touchdowns, which is not where Rice wants to be, but I if that can happen. And another part of the offense that I think, as we've seen the progression over the course of the year, and that what they did really well against UTEP, so they were 6 for 11 on third downs. So converting, anytime Rice converts more than 50% of their third downs, that's a win, especially if you're talking about a team that it was somewhere in the 30s, I think, for most of the year. So that one piece, and then red zone efficiency. Rice got into the red zone 4 times and finished with 4 scoring drives. That's what you have to do. If you are going to have the good fortune of having multiple, 40, 50 yard touchdown plays, you'd love that. But if you're not, and you're going to have to grind, you need to score when you get the opportunity. And you only had that one turnover was not in the red zone, and you left with more points than the other team. I thought it was probably not I wouldn't label it as a fantastic offensive performance, but it was good. It was really, really good, and it got the job done.
Yeah, I mean, they only ran 52 overall plays, and they got 371 yards on those plays. I mean, 7 yards per play, you're going to do all right, especially when, UTEP ran, 68 plays and got 312 yards. So, you have a solid, almost a 2 yard per play edge over the course of a game. You're going to win most of those games.
Yeah, and Rice had the luxury to be able to lean on what they wanted to, and that was the running game. And the running game worked today. And the UTEP defensive front is not great, and especially they didn't have a ton of pressure at all. What do they have finished? I think they finished with maybe 1 sack. But even in the running game, they weren't much of a much pressure at all. And Rice was able to kind of get their blockers and their extra man, and whether that be a tight end or a fullback, and kind of have their way and move the ball on the ground, which is Rice right where Rice wants to be, and set up those third and manageables and kind of control the clock. But even when I was watching this, it didn't really, I don't know if I had this vision of what, Rice controlling the clock looked like, but this game was much more so of, it felt like Rice was effectively moving the ball and not sticking to a predetermined formula of run, keep it on the ground, run, run. It felt like Rice had an offense that was kind of able to do what they wanted to. Mm-hmm. So it was really nice to see. And again, 2 penalties, 17 yards. I haven't checked yet. I believe that means Rice is more than likely going to finish the year as the least penalized team in the nation. Which, pretty nice.
That's very satisfying, which, I think I've said something to this effect before, but, one of the things that you should be able to guarantee when you're, you're building a team at a place like Rice is, you're not going to get all the fastest guys out there. You're not going to get all the biggest guys out there, but you're going to get some pretty damn smart guys. And so, if your coaching staff is doing a good job, you ought to be able to have guys who can play really, really disciplined football and know what they're supposed to be doing at all times. And seeing Rice, and there's always some fluctuation there. And, when you're, I never have a problem with effort penalties, a not terribly egregious holding or defensive passive interference, whatever. That's a guy trying to make a play that, sometimes you want to.
Sometimes it's not the worst thing.
Yeah. You're not trying hard enough if you don't get those plays sometimes, right? To have such a minimum of procedural penalties and, the things that are just bonehead errors that you should be able to avoid at all times. It was really gratifying all year to see this team just not make a lot of those errors.
Like the Egg Bowl fiasco. I had we won't go into that. The only reason I bring it up is because I was on of course, Twitter exploded. And if you missed that, just go Google Egg Bowl penalty, and I'm pretty sure it'll come up.
Yeah,
actually, search it on Twitter, and you'll probably be laughing for for half an hour, but I note that because the Rice video coordinator Roger is you know, I've gotten to know him pretty well, and he does a really, really good job with all sorts of production for Rice. And he tweeted as soon as that happened, a GIF of something effective. Oh, every special teams coordinator in America is currently pulling that GIF for their team meetings the next weekend. And I think someone else on the team responded with, yes, Sabota's already requested it. So I haven't actually checked to see if that was shown in the pregame meetings. Of course, the Egg Bowl was on a Thursday, so Rice would have had ample time to see that. Right. But yeah, Rice didn't get very many of those penalties, and Rice ended up winning those close games down the stretch.
Now, granted, I personally don't believe that celebration penalties should exist, but you know, rules being what they are, it's. You never want to cost your team 15 yards, especially when it's going to cause you to lose a rivalry game and get your head coach fired because you missed an extra point afterwards. But, you know. Well, and that's the thing, though, is that, like, the Egg Bowl, more than maybe any other rivalry in college football, they will absolutely, like, you could, it doesn't matter what happens the rest of the year. They just, Mississippi, they get so ornery about that game, and they will absolutely fire a dude for losing it, and they did.
Yeah,
it was great.
It's, you know, I mean, speaking of rivalries, and we kind of, I guess, teased this last week, of course, so Rice will get their rivalry dose of the Bayou Bucket coming back beginning of next year, in which Rice is entering that game on a winning streak, which is something that, what, I guess 50% of the programs in the, well, how many, let's see, about what, 70 teams something make a bowl, half the teams don't, so there's probably what, going to be like 40 teams in the country coming into next year on a winning streak of any kind, maybe, give or take, something like that. Yeah, Rice will have one of the longest winning streaks in the country, probably one of the top 20 having a 3-game winning streak, somewhere around there.
I'll take it.
I'll take it. And so Rice plays, of course, Houston to start next year. And they also had 3 FBS wins. But they also had De'Aaron King. So, or kind of did. So we'll get into more of that. But a pique your interest for 2020, Rice will start out of the game with the start out of the gate with some big games that will be exciting to break down in the coming weeks.
All right. Any more on UTEP before we do a little redshirt talk?
Let's see. I did want to note that Blaze Aldridge, we talked about him a couple times, ended up finishing second in the nation in tackles for a loss, which, phenomenal year. Absolutely. And then actually I had somebody reach out to me this week after the Pro Football Focus teams came out for the season. And they said, did I miss something? Did they do something wrong? How did Blaze not end up on any of the PFF teams? And I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know it's probably more of calculating numbers based and not, we don't like Blaze. And I will say that they only included two interior linebackers they just had linebackers and is how they differentiated in edge rushers or something like that. But only
to outside linebackers, the guys who were over really more of pass rushers as edge defenders.
Right. So they only had 6 guys. And then, and I will say this, the linebacking depth in Conference USA is actually pretty, pretty good. As far as positional strength goes, I think you can probably knock some of the pass rushers a little bit and probably a lot of the offensive skill players comparatively to the other conferences, but I think linebacker is actually where Conference USA is pretty strong. So I think, you know, obviously Blaze probably deserves to be on that list, and the conference will put out their list at some point. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you Blaze will be at least an honorable mention, if not higher, at least second team, I'd hope. But yeah, heck of a year for him, and always nice to end the year with a shutout in the second half. And I think what you know, you say, yeah, but it's UTEP. But what a good defense is supposed to do to a bad offense is to not let them score points. Yep. And that's what happened. And I think it's safe to say that Rice has a really good defense, and Miles Adams had a good game, but wasn't even probably one of the handful of players that, you know, flashed and had some moments. You had 14 tackles, career high for Blaze. Antonio Montero had 11. I mean, you got Naeem Smith had a big TFL, and a couple guys. Cam Ballantyne, I saw, ended up getting a lot of run for the first time this season. Javonte Hubbard was a difference maker up in the middle. So many different guys that I thought really stepped up to the point where it wasn't just, oh, well, they have Blaze and he's really good. But I felt like there was a lot of people's name, a lot of different people whose names were getting called on the defensive side of the ball. That got me really encouraged for what's coming back.
Yeah, that's the thing that's even kind of crazier about it is, like, yeah, they bring back all of the starters except for Miles Adams, but it's not like they, you know, have a whole bunch of, like, senior rotation guys that you end up losing, and so you're losing maybe kind of a hidden chunk of your returning production there. They rotated in a lot of guys on defense at basically every position. Like, there were probably, you know, I haven't gone through and, you know, checked out the stats or anything like that, but I don't have access to the snap counts, I don't think, but, like, the number of guys that they brought in at every position on defense in particular was really, really impressive. And they get, you know, out of what, probably 20 guys that either saw significant action at some point during the season or rotated in regularly, like, 19 of them are back on one side of the ball. So it's really exciting to think about what this defense could do in Conference USA next year, as long as they're reasonably healthy.
Yeah, and there's so many guys, like you said, that can be a part of it. That they, I'm knock on wood, I'm not going to say that they can afford to get injured, but they'll have a good amount of depth that they can be able to weather the loss of somebody, and they won't be dependent on any one or two players. I think that's pretty safe to say. Yeah, so Rice, looking at participation here, it looks like Rice had 37 different players play in that game against UTEP, which you're talking 11 guys on offense, 11 guys on defense, a kicker and a punter. We get to 24. So you're talking about having another dozen guys that played a good amount of reps, mm-hmm. and made some big plays. So a lot of things to look forward to. And I guess if you want to mark that the cap of our UTEP last regular season game recap.
Yep, I think that'll do it.
And last note that we can kind of touch on are the red shirt pieces. And I went ahead, you can go ahead and find it. And if you're ever just looking for football stuff, just go to atthirst.com/football, or we have a tab right on there on the left-hand side of the page that one of the things you can click on, it's forum, shop, and football. So you can click football, find that. And I went ahead and just did a red shirt report of the guys. I pulled out the seniors. I pulled out some of the guys like Rhett Cardwell and Sam Glaceman, who red shirt juniors who walked on senior day, who, you know, were not projecting at this point to be back, and just kind of looked at the numbers. And so I'll read a couple of these guys, and maybe you, Carter, you can give me some of your thoughts that fell under that four game red shirt. We had a Kebron Page, Cole Garcia, Miles McCord, Brant Peterson on the offensive line, Javonte Johnson, Myron Morrison, Zay Knipp, Josh Piercy, and Josh Landrum were the guys who capped in right at four. Anybody in there that we have or haven't talked to that sticks out to you as interesting?
We've hit most of them that have.
I'll tick on one that I don't know if we've covered too much in depth. I was going to say Cole Garcia was an interesting name that I don't know if going into the season I kind of expected him to be a redshirt.
Right, yeah. I mean, because he was really in competition for one of the starting spots. after, because he started a bunch as a freshman. He was a true freshman last year, right? And didn't started enough that he didn't redshirt. So it's interesting that they sort of.
Yeah, I think he ended up playing maybe 8 or 9 games, started the majority of those at the guard spot, and was one of those guys that he came in. He actually, his action he got in later in the year was because of injuries and guys not being able to go. And he's the kind of guy that, you know, is a good rotational piece. I don't know. And I was going back in my preparation for offensive player of the year and newcomer of the year this year. He was actually the guy that won I awarded the offensive rookie of the year last year, because if you remember, we saw a little bit of Wiley and a little bit of Juma, but he was one of the few freshman new guys last year that actually played the majority of the games and played really, really well. So to be able to have a guy like that on your roster who has, you know, now what, a dozen games of D1 experience on the offensive line. I mean, I think Rice is going to go out and add some depth on the offensive line if they can. But like you were talking about when we were talking about the participation for the UTEP game, having players like that coming back on your roster is huge.
Yeah, and especially at that spot, because, you know, they lose 2 out of 3, you know, at least from the lineup you had most of the year. You lose 2 out of 3 interior starters on the offensive line, and then your right tackle as well, the guys that were all grad transfers. And so,
yeah, you know, and Brant Peterson's another guy. He's more of a tackle kind of prospect, probably played right tackle opposite of Clave Servin. He had a 4-game redshirt as well.
Yeah. So it's really nice to be getting those guys back. And obviously Clarkowski helps us even more. But so, you know, you are nominally replacing 3 out of 5 on your offensive line. And, you know, you might say, like, you know, the running game wasn't maybe as efficient as they wanted it to be this year. And, you know, one of the things that's going to be key to making more progress next year is to continue to get better on the offensive line, so that, you know, when they lean on the run game like they want to, can, you know, you churn out the gains that you need to stay ahead of the chains. And so it really helps losing those 3 grad transfers to have guys who, even though they weren't starters, who have significant playing time. And so, you know, you could fill out this line again next year with guys who, you know, 3 of them weren't starters this year, but all of them got extensive starting or playing experience during either this season or last. And so, you know, even if you don't bring in another grad transfer or something like that, so you feel pretty good about what they can bring in to replace those guys on the offensive line.
Yeah. And I'm actually just kind of scrolling through this list now and looking at, so they had those 2 guys already mentioned on the offensive line. They had Jerry Johnson played 3 games. Hunter Jones played 3 games. Derek Ferraro, 2. Clarkowski, 2. Reagan Riddle, 2. And that's it for the offensive linemen. But you're talking about most of those guys, true freshmen, brought in a pretty big class of offensive linemen. They were able to get those guys into games and play and get experience. And this is what the intention, you know, the actions of a school across town aside, this is what the intention of the redshirt rule was supposed to be. It was supposed to give you a chance to throw guys into the fire, let them have live game reps and kind of get some experience before you're going to ask guys that, you know, like Isaac Clarkowski, to go out and his season would have looked a lot different if they would have said, first off, if he hadn't gotten to play because of the redshirt rules. He's the kind of guy that benefits from this, because I don't think you throw in a walk-on to start at center unless you absolutely have to, which maybe you could argue Rice did. And you know, so that point. And B, like, if his first college football game is against Army, that's a lot different than Middle Tennessee.
Yeah, well, and it helps a ton. You know, he's also another example of exactly what the rules intended for, is that sometimes you get to the end of the year and there's an emergency situation and you have to bring a guy up who hasn't played at all and kind of press him into a spot start. And previously, you know, he comes in and starts these 2 games. Well, he's just lost a whole year of eligibility because another guy got hurt and he played in 2 games. So it's really good to be able to get guys in and to be able to you know, hit the break glass in case of emergency button without, you know, significantly shortening a guy's college career, because, you know, a dude happened to get hurt, which happens all the time in football.
Yeah, and it's also completely ridiculous. I'm looking at my list right now, and I was having a trouble finding Klarkowski. That's because I still have him listed as a defensive tackle. because that's what he was on the roster, because he was working with scout team defense all year. And now he's your starting center, which ridiculous. But, So, and then a couple more guys that I think they were interesting, notable guys that redshirted this year. Chike Anigbogu. He plays safety, and I guess the main reason he redshirted was because Rice had some really good safeties. I mean, Prudy, he was my defensive rookie of the year last year, and he got supplanted not because he wasn't playing well or all that different, but because Naeem Smith was playing so well. Mm-hmm. And Chike is one of those guys. He's kind of just stuck behind a good crop of safety. So he was a really involved special teams player. I mentioned, you know, Garrett Grammer earlier at the beginning of this podcast. You know, he's the kind of guy that, you know, I think we could see kind of sliding into that role next year as being kind of a special teams do-it-all kind of player. And that's kind of where he stood out during practices and has been pretty heavily involved on that side of the ball. And then Juma on offense got to redshirt. Juwan King played in two games. He got to redshirt. And then Aiden Noriega, Joshon Palmer, you know, some guys that either were injured or were kind of scout team guys that might be depth pieces later, didn't get really involved. So, but I think on offense, really the biggest value that I'm kind of seeing here is coming from the offensive line.
Yeah, definitely. And the other the name that sticks out big to me and the guys that kind of played in 2 to 3 games is Isaiah Floyd. You know, they didn't end up, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the season, we were previewing the defense. I wondered if he would kind of have to have a big role, because, you know, being a guy that just, they didn't have a whole ton of depth at defensive tackle. And clearly DeBraylon Carroll was a guy who kind of ascended there and ended up playing in all 12 games himself. If you were to make a list of your notable freshmen not red shirts, he would be pretty close to the top. But yeah, a guy like Isaiah Floyd, who is really the biggest guy they have on the defensive line, and a guy with a really high ceiling that we're really excited for the future about. They got to preserve a year of eligibility for him. So,
yeah, and it's interesting that he was actually, I think, midway through the season, the first bye week, they really started working on a package on defense that had him a part of it. They kind of figured out, okay, when and where do we fit this guy in? And ended up, because of his size, his ability to kind of plug holes up the middle, as building in a really specific run stopping package for him to the situation of, okay, we need to stop someone from running the football. Well, teams didn't really run well against Rice this year to begin with. And a lot of the limited usage was, well, we don't really need a run stop specialist right now because people are trying to throw on us because they're coming back and Rice had leads, or, you know, we're back and forth and in an even game script, which meant lots of college football offenses were throwing it, you know, or B, I think Miles Adams pretty exceeded expectations this year. He had a good year last year, but I don't think in the preseason, he was kind of one of those guys that I thought, well, like, he's a senior, he'll get some run, but I don't know if he's going to be able to hold off these talented freshmen. And like, he played some of his best football of his Rice football career and had a phenomenal year. And so I think that part of the reason that you saw we had other guys like Elijah Garcia, another guy on the defensive line that had a heck of a season. And Javonte Hubbard, we mentioned so many other guys that were playing well. I think last year in 2018, we saw a lot of freshmen come in because the guys in front of them were not making plays and not getting things done. And I don't think that's what we saw this year. There wasn't a call for, okay, we need somebody else who's next, because the guys who were there for the most part playing pretty well. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned DeBraylon. He was actually the final tally. So DeBraylon Carroll, Adrian Bickham, defensive end, and really did a lot of special teams work as well, and Jack Bradley, tight end. Those were the only three freshmen that played in every single game this year. And so last year, I think the final tally ended up being four guys that played in every single game. And so now you're at three, which is probably a healthy indication of where the program's going, that you only have a select group of a few guys that are difference maker type players that are playing in every game as true freshmen.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I said some stuff this year about how I'm not sure there's any coaching staff in the country that made as good of usage of the four-game redshirt rule as this staff did last year. And this year, they didn't have quite so many of those guys whose contributions they had to come in and, you know, use for two games here, another guy for three games, another guy for four games. They still had a fair amount of those guys, but not quite as many of them this year because they didn't need them. Because the guys they had were actually playing really well. And, you know, you love to see guys like Adams and Garcia, like, you know, as much turnover as there has been, you know, going back to the other side of the ball, Aston Walter's a really good example here. As much turnover as there's been with this roster in the first couple years, it's really good to see those guys who, you know, you think about a true senior on this team has the seasons he's played through. Three wins, one win, two wins, three wins. That's a pretty rough stretch to have that be your 4 years of college football. But you know, to see the guys who are seniors or redshirt juniors who are still there making an impact and that really stood out on this team, I think it says a lot about those guys.
Yeah, and it was a really good balance. You mentioned that was so there ended up being, I don't have the number for last year, but this year they had 23 guys that played in at least one game, and they were able to redshirt. And, you know, like you mentioned, there was a lot of, I think some of the core pieces of this team were a lot of juniors, honestly, on offense. You had the grad guys on the line, but a lot of experienced players recruited by this staff or not that really were able to make a difference on that side of the football. So I think it was a good mix. It kind of felt like, you know, this year was supposed to be, if last year was year zero and this was year 1.5, year two, but after mid rebuild, but not fully in, whatever you call the in between, I think you were kind of expecting to see a less of a reliance on true freshmen to carry a load. And I think that's what you saw this year. And you ended up seeing, there's one guy, Jacob Grams, who is a safety, but really is a kind of a special teams guy. He played in five games, and he was the only player on the roster that played in five or six games. Every other player on the roster played in four or fewer or seven or more, which I think there was a pretty good evaluation prior to the year and during the season about how good these guys were, what they needed in terms of training and playing time, and be able to make decisions coming into the year of, you know, who did they think was going to be enough of a key piece that they needed to play them more than, you know, a redshirt. And so you saw a lot of guys that there wasn't really many. There was only, I think, probably four or five guys coming into the final UTEP game that was like, okay, we have to shut them down because we probably could. We would like to use them in some capacity, but we want to preserve their redshirt. It was a lot of, well, you know, these guys are going to be on the field. I mean, Trayshawn Devone's true freshman. He started. Kirk Lockhart is a guy that played a lot at safety, you know, when guys went down for injury and did a lot of special teams work. I mean, Zach Hoban handled kickoffs. He played in nine games. These guys that Jason White, like your nickel corner reserve, you know, played behind Andrew Bird and Tyree Thornton for most of the year. He was in for eight games. So it was a lot like that where you saw the staff do a pretty good job evaluating their roster and saying, you know, we need this guy, or we will need this guy in the future. So we'll give him some run, but preserve his redshirt. So I was pretty encouraged by how the redshirt usage played out this year on the whole, I'd say. And really, a lot of those guys that, you know, got cut around that 7 or 8 game, 9 game mark that didn't play were injuries. You know, Anthony Akpe, Trey Schumann, they both played in 8 games. Uzoma Suje played in 9. He had a little bit of an injury and was kind of a reserve piece anywhere. Like, Andrew Bird played in 10, missed his games with injuries. Trayshon DeVoe's, his only missed game was with the flu. So the guys that were in, were in. And the guys that were redshirting, were redshirting. It was a pretty clear line, which gives us a lot to be optimistic about for the future, I think.
All right. Anything else for this week for our final, I guess we'll call next week the final regular season episode since it's the wrap up show. But any last bits for this week?
That's everything I have to say about UTEP for at least another year, or whenever that falls on the schedule. If you could please go ahead and take that survey, let us know what you think about the site, the podcast, everything in between. And then if you have anything notable of, you know, a potential name for our awards or a play or player or kind of, you know, I wish my favorite college football podcast would give an award for this. You know, let us know. Maybe you'll make it in. It'd be fun. So thanks again enough for covering all of us for listening and interacting and enjoying this season. We've had a lot of fun and we got a little bit more in the tank. So don't go anywhere just yet.
Yeah, we appreciate y'all sticking with us through it. First 3 quarters of the season were a little rough, but hey, we pulled it out at the end. So those of you that stuck it out with us to this point, we really appreciate you. We'll see you back next week for our postmortem on the season and Rice Fight.
This show was edited and produced by Carter Spires. It features music from Joseph McDade.